You're listening to the Berkshire Hathaway Annual Shareholders Meeting Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Yahoo Finance.
Let me follow up with this one. Then this one comes in from Manish Bal, who says, is there a risk of permanent loss of capital in the oil equity investments?
Well, there certainly is. You know, there's no question. If oil stays at these prices, there's going to be a lot of money, a whole lot of money, and it'll extend to bank loans, and it'll affect the banking industry to some degree. Not it doesn't destroy them or anything, but there's a lot of money that's been invested that was not invested based on a $17 or $20 or $25 price for WTI, West Texas Intermediate Oil. And but you can do the same thing in copper. You can do the same thing in some of the things we manufacture. I mean, but with commodities, it's particularly dramatic. And, farmers have been getting lousy prices, but to some extent, the government subsidizes them. I'm all for it, actually. But if you're an oil producer, you take your chances on future prices, unless you want to sell a lot of futures forward. Oxy actually did sell 300,000 barrels a day of puts, in effect, or they bought puts and sold calls, in effect, to match it. And they were protected at $10 for a layer of $10 a barrel on 300,000 barrels a day. But you're really buying, when you buy oil, you're betting on oil prices over time and over a long time. And oil prices, there's risk, and the risk is being realized by oil producers as we speak. There will be, if these prices prevail, there will be a lot of bad loans and energy loans and bad debts and energy loans. And if there are bad debts and energy loans, you can imagine what happens to the equity holders. So yes, there's risk.
All right, this question comes from Bob Coleman. He says, Warren, could you bring us up to date with the status of your equity put contracts? Sourcing the 2019 annual report found on page 60, it appears at 2019 year-end, the fair value liability was just under $1 billion. And if the indexes declined 30%, the liability obligations balloon to $2.7 billion. So if the indexes are down 60%, would Berkshire's obligation be close to $5.5 billion? Does that math seem reasonable? And are there any loose ends or open exposures associated with
the puts? No, between 2004, I think, and 2006, I think we wrote 48. Maybe 50 contracts, something like that. The shortest was 15 years. The longest was 20 years. And we received, as I remember, roughly $4.8 billion, which we were free to do with what we wanted. And we agreed to pay based on where one or more of four indices were selling for at the time of expiration. They were so-called European-style puts, where they're only payable based on one date. And we did not have, with a small exception, we did not have to put up collateral, which was part of the deal. And we've had that $4.8 billion. We probably had an original nominal value of something over $30 billion, maybe $35 billion. That's if everything went to zero. If Dow Jones went to zero, the FTSE went to zero, and the Nikkei and so on. A number of those have run off, so we now have about $14 billion nominal. We have something less than half left. We haven't paid out anything significant. We bought back a few of them. If everything went to zero, we would owe $14 billion. If everything were to sell at the same price it was selling for on March 31st, I think the number is somewhat less than we carry as a liability on the balance sheet, which is $2 and a fraction billion. So far, so good. I mean, we've had the use of a lot of money, and the outstanding potential of them is the market went up a lot. We wouldn't have to pay anything. And if it goes down some more, we have to pay more than a couple of billion, but we've got the liability set up for that. But so far, so good on that. And it is not anything that causes us any problem. They come due, the final one I think comes due sometime in 2023. I think there's, I think maybe 20 or 25% of them come due late this year. And so it's there's nothing that the questioner doesn't really understand about them. I can tell by the question, and there's no surprises there. There's no way that some liability could double up on us except based on, except relating to where those indices close at the expiration of a group of different puts, which, like I say, have been more than cut in half. And we've done very well on it. Key to that.
Warren, you mentioned a few minutes ago that
I was just going to say was, with just a couple of tiny exceptions, we did not agree to put up collateral. We never would have gotten ourselves in that position. And that was when we made the deals, we just would not get ourselves in that position, and we never will, where on a given date, we could have some tremendous obligation that would come due that we weren't count on getting having come due. I'm done then, Becky. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. So you mentioned a few minutes ago that you're very concerned about Berkshire's long-term health, too. This question came in from Drew Estes in Atlanta, Georgia, who says, there's already speculation of a post-Buffett breakup of Berkshire, and given the sway carried by modern activists, the speculation should be taken seriously. Many long-term owners see the folly in this view. A $25 billion ancillary earnings stream provides a lot of flexibility when investing insurance float. On our and your estate's behalf, could you more forcefully make the case of maintaining Berkshire's current architecture? If you don't, that responsibility will fall on an unknown set of shoulders with far less credibility.
Well, if you were to sell Berkshire's various subsidiaries, you would incur a very significant amount of tax at the corporate level before anything was distributed to the shareholders. You can spin off a given one or something of the sort, but the ability to break up a diverse company without tax implications, there was something called the General Utilities doctrine that prevailed in various ways up until 1986, and a lot of people seem to comment based on the fact that that didn't happen in 1986. And there's imaginative ways where people try to avoid taxes and can do it in some cases. On certain types of transactions, if you were to break up Berkshire, that would be one factor. But the interaction of being able to move capital around in terms of being able to do things in insurance that we couldn't do unless there were the backup earnings and capital employed in the other entities, there's enormous advantages in capital deployment within the place. So there is not a big discount to break up value embodied in Berkshire's price. And the situation actually is that although all my Berkshire shares, every share, will be given to charities pursuant to a plan I developed back 14 years ago, and followed ever since, and will continue following this July. I'll be giving away $3 billion or so worth of the stock. But it involves a big voting percentage that, including other people that still remain in the picture, aside even from the Buffett family, it isn't going to happen. Now, I will tell you, everybody in the world will come around and propose something and say it's wonderful for shareholders. And by the way, it involves huge fees. I mean, you do not You do not get impartial advice from Wall Street when there's enormous amount of fees possible from one action and no fees applicable from another action. But you can be sure I've thought about it, and I would say that you can count on Berkshire's present posture being continued for a long time. I can't tell you what's going to happen 100 years from now. And I can't tell you exactly what would happen, for example, if certain ideas in terms of wealth taxes changed or taxes on foundations change. I mean, but my plan has been thought out and in place for a long time. And it not only ensures that the money that's been made off Berkshire, all of it ends up going to various philanthropies staggered over time, but it also will keep the wolves away. Greg, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think the comment on the capital allocation is critical, that we have the ability to move the capital amongst the, be it the operating businesses or up to the insurance or down, with really no consequences to our shareholders. That's the value driver, the unique structure of Berkshire, and it creates immense value. So that's all I would add, or second, I guess.
All right, this question comes from Rob Grandish in Washington, D.C. He says, interest rates are negative in much of Europe, also in Japan. Warren has written many times that the value of Berkshire's insurance companies derived from the fact that policyholders pay up front, creating insurance float, on which Berkshire gets to earn interest. If interest rates are negative, then collecting money up front will be costly rather than profitable. If interest rates are negative, then the insurance float is no longer a benefit but a liability. Can you please discuss how Berkshire's insurance companies would respond if interest rates became negative in the United States?
Well, they were going to be negative for a long time. You better own equities, or you better own something other than debt. I mean, it's remarkable what's happened in the last 10 years. I've been wrong in thinking that you could really have the developments you've had without inflation taking hold, but we have 120 odd billion. Well, we have some almost very high percentage in treasury bills, some in other, and some just in cash. But those treasury bills are paying us virtually nothing. Now, they're a terrible investment over time, but they are the one thing that when opportunity arises, it will arise at a time, and maybe the only thing you can look to pay for those opportunities is the treasury bills you have. I mean, the rest of the world may have stopped. And we also need them to protect, be sure that we can pay the liabilities we have in terms of policyholders over time. And we take that very seriously. So if the world turns into a world where you can issue more and more money and have negative interest rates over time, I'd have to see it to believe it, but I've seen a little bit of it. I've been surprised. So I've been wrong so far. I do not think that I don't see how you can create. I would say this. If you can have negative interest rates and pour out money and incur more and more debt relative to productive capacity, you'd think the world would have discovered it in the first couple thousand years rather than just coming on it now. But we will see. It's probably the most interesting question I've ever seen in economics is can you keep doing what we're doing now? And we've been able to do it, or the world's been able to do it for now a dozen years or so. But we may be facing a period where we're testing that hypothesis that you can continue it with a lot more force than we've tested it before. Greg, do you have any thoughts on that? I wish I knew the answer. Maybe you do.
No, I think as you articulated, I think it was in the annual report too. I mean, we don't know the answer, but as you said, some of the fundamentals right now are very interesting relative to having a negative interest rate. But I hate to say it, but I don't have anything to add.
Yeah, I'd love to be Secretary of the Treasury if I knew I could keep raising money at negative interest rates. That makes life pretty simple. We're doing things that we really don't know the ultimate outcome to. I think in general they're the right things, but I don't think they're without consequences. And I think they could be kind of extreme consequences pushed far enough, but there would be kind of extreme consequences if we didn't do it as well. So somebody asks us to balance those questions.
All right, this question comes from Adam Schwartz in Miami, Florida. He says, Berkshire is the largest holding in his partnership, which also houses most of their net worth. He says, Berkshire's invested in many capital-intensive businesses through the years, railroads as an example. How do you think about the inflationary or even deflationary risks for all of the capital-intensive businesses, and could this prove to be an existential problem for businesses? Kind of referencing what you were just talking about, that eventually the bill for the debts being issued comes due. Will it eventually come from all businesses through some combination of higher tax rates on corporations, increased wages for the lower middle class,
et cetera? Well, I certainly think that increased corporate taxes are a much higher probability than having lower corporate taxes. So I think that we got handed as a corporation a big chunk of what used to be the government's profits from our business a couple of years ago. And it would depend on, to some extent, which party is elected and whether they have control of both houses as well as the presidency and who knows what else. But we could very easily have higher corporate income taxes and perhaps much higher corporate income taxes at some point. And in terms of capital intensive businesses, they're just not as good if you can find an equally good business. I mean, in terms of operations, that doesn't require capital. I mean, C's never required capital. It didn't grow, but it didn't take money to expand it. And it delivered enormous sums to us. And because we own it within Berkshire, to redeploy it elsewhere didn't require a lot of tax expense, either at the corporate level or at the personal level. So you really want a business, and everybody wants a business, that doesn't take any capital to speak of and keeps growing and doesn't take more capital as it grows. Now, our utility business, our energy business, requires more capital as it grows. Our railroad business, to some extent, requires more capital if it doesn't grow even. So capital-intensive businesses, by their nature, are not as good as something where people pay in advance and you don't need the capital. I mean, if you look at where the top market value is in a $30 trillion market, if you take the top four or five companies that account for, maybe $4 trillion of or so of that $30 trillion, basically they don't take much capital. And that's why they're worth a lot of money, because they make a lot of money and they don't require the money to any great extent in the business. We own some businesses like that, but it's certainly not the railroad. And it's not the energy business. They're good businesses. We love them. But if they didn't take any capital, they'd be unbelievable. But that's what we've learned from 50 or 60 years of operating businesses, that if you can find a great business that doesn't require capital when it grows, you've really got something. And to a certain extent, because insurance uses the kind of assets we would like to own anyway, our insurance business doesn't really take capital. It requires having capital available, but we're able to invest that money largely in things we'd like to own anyway. So we're particularly well-suited for the insurance business, and it's really been the most important factor in our growth over the years, although a lot of other things contribute. Greg, you're in the capital. You were in the capital intensive business a long time. Tell us about it.
Well, I think there's no question. Obviously, we'd prefer to be in a less capital intensive business, but there are unique opportunities there. And the one I would touch on when I think of inflation, or even potentially as we go through this crisis and maybe a prolonged one, or how, depending on how long it takes to recover. I mean, we are in a unique, when we're looking at energy or rail, we do have a certain amount of pricing power. And it's through our regulatory formulas or how our arrangements are with our customers. So if we then were to move into an inflationary period, it's not perfect protection, but those businesses generally can recover a significant portion of their costs, even in an inflationary environment, and still earn a reasonable return. They're not going to be great returns, as you highlighted, Warren, but they're still going to earn a reasonable return on their capital, even in an inflationary period. There may be some lag and some things like that, but they're still going to be very sound investments.
So. Oh, yeah. If there was 10-for-1 inflation, make it extreme, we'd be happy we owned the railroad, very happy. We'd be investing a lot of capital in it, but that business is, in my view, is a very, very solid business for many, 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 many decades to come. I said originally we bought it with a 100-year time horizon, and I've extended that. So it will earn more dollars if there's a lot of inflation. In real terms, who knows? But it would earn a lot more dollars, and a lot of the energy projects would. But it's better if we don't have inflation, and it's better if we don't have capital. if we can find the same sort of businesses that aren't as capital intensive, we've got capital. I mean, we're ideally positioned for capital intensive businesses that other people have trouble raising capital for, but they've still got to promise decent returns.
All right, this question comes from Charlie Wang. He's a shareholder in San Francisco. He says, given the unprecedented time of the economy and the debt level, could there be any risks and consequences of the U.S. government defaulting on its bonds?
No. If you print bonds in your own currency, what happens to the currency is it can be a question, but you don't default. The United States has been smart enough, and people have trusted us enough to issue its debt in its own currency. And Argentina is now having a problem because the debt isn't in their own currency, and lots of countries have had that problem, and lots of countries will have that problem in the future. It is very painful to owe money in somebody else's currency. But if you listen, if I could issue a currency, Buffett bucks, and I had a printing press, I could borrow money, and I could borrow money on that, I would never default. So what you end up getting in terms of purchasing power can be in doubt. But in terms of the U.S. government, when Standard & Poor's downgraded the United States government, I think it was Standard & Poor's some years back, that to me did not make sense. I mean, in the end, how you can regard any corporation as stronger than a person who can print the money to pay you, I just don't understand. So don't worry about the government defaulting. I think it's kind of crazy, incidentally, this should be said, to have these limits on the debt and all of that sort of thing, and then stop the government arguing about whether it's going to increase the limits. We're going to increase the limits on the debt. The debt isn't going to be paid. It's going to be refunded. And anybody that thinks they're going to bring down the national debt, I mean, there's been brief periods, and I think it was in the late 90s or thereabouts, when the debt's come down a little bit, the country's going to print more debt. The country's going to grow in terms of its debt-paying capacity. But the trick is to keep borrowing in your own currency.
emphasis on the trick. This question comes from David Cass. He is a clinical professor of finance at the University of Maryland, and he says, Berkshire has invested in many companies with stock buyback programs. Recently, there's been a backlash against buybacks. What are your views on this subject?
Well, it's very politically correct to be against buybacks now. I mean, and, you know, and they're going to incorporate it in the loan program. I mean, there's a lot of crazy things said on buybacks. Buybacks are so simple. I mean, it's a way of distributing cash to shareholders. And let's just say that you and I and Greg, the three of us, decide to buy an auto dealership or a McDonald's franchise or something, and we each put $1 million in, you know, or whatever the number may be. And we get along with each other, and the business grows and all of that. And one of us really wants to spend our share of the earnings. And the other two want to leave the money in the business to grow. Now, if the three of us did that, and we're the only shareholders, we would not establish a 100% dividend payout for everybody, and we wouldn't freeze the one that wanted to get out either. The logical thing to do is to buy a portion, whatever that person wants to spend annually from the earnings, buy a portion of their stock, and the other two find their interest in the company goes up, and the third person still has a little more of an interest by what they leave in, but they also can take some money out of the business. So you're taking money out of the business in either case, and one you call dividends and you send it to everybody whether they want it or not. And with buybacks, you give it to the ones who want the money. And I have been following a policy of giving away stock now since 2006, and I'll give away a lot of stock, but the people, the philanthropies that receive it, the gifts have to spend the money very promptly within, you know, on a current basis, more or less. So they are getting $3 billion worth of stock or whatever it may be, and I'm in effect reducing my interest in Berkshire, but Berkshire's still retaining more capital than I'm giving away. So I have more dollars invested, but my interest goes down. And the people that need the cash to carry out the philanthropic efforts, they cash out the stock. And I don't force my sister or whoever it may be to take a bunch of money she doesn't want. She wants it reinvested, all of it reinvested in the business. And people that don't want to can sell some of their stock. And the company ends up in the same position. We've distributed some of the capital that we don't need for growth. Now, whether the company should buy it depends on a couple of things. One is they ought to retain the money they need for intelligent growth prospects. That's fine. And secondly, and this is a point that's never mentioned, they should be buying it back below what they think it's worth. Now, they'll make mistakes in that, but you make mistakes in a lot of business decisions. But over that should be the guiding principle. And to my knowledge, J.P. Morgan, Jamie Dimon said it once, and we've said it various times. You know, we retain, we will repurchase shares when it's to the advantage of the continuing shareholder to have us do so. But you read about all these buyback programs, they say we're going to spend $5 billion buying it back, or $10 billion. Well, that's like saying I'm going to go out and buy some business this year for $5 billion without knowing what you're going to get for the money. It should be price sensitive, obviously. It should be needs sensitive, obviously. But when the conditions are right, it should also be obvious to repurchase shares, and there shouldn't be the slightest taint to it any more than there is to dividends. And people that have now sort of taken up the cries about how terrible it was that companies bought back stock, well, you can say it was terrible for them to pay dividends too, then they'd have more money now. But they were doing what was intelligent at the time, and I hope they continue to do what's intelligent as they go forth. Greg?
No, the only thing I know you've commented on in the past, Warren, is that I think the one thing we are seeing, and obviously we're supportive of buybacks, but there are companies that used probably their financial engineering was just a little
extreme
and too cute, that effectively you're using every ounce of your balance sheet to buy back stock at a time where you're really creating no cushion for your business for any type of event or bump in the road. And I, you know, we're going to see that. And I think that's a very unfortunate outcome of them. And hence you get some of the backlash. But there's still companies, as you highlighted, many that do it right.
Yeah. Now, if they're buying it back because it's fashionable, because they really do like the idea, there's nothing wrong with taking an action that increases the value of the remaining shares. But if they're doing it very, and incidentally, I've been witness to some programs where it really is stupid. But I don't think it's immoral. I just think it's stupid, you know, basically. And on the other hand, we favor companies that take care of all their requirements for growth. And as Greg says, maintain sound balance sheets and all of that. Leave a margin of error for things that you can get surprised with. And if they find their stock selling below the business is intrinsically worth, I think that they're making a big mistake if they don't buy in their stock. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a political football. And like I say, that when it becomes politically correct to do something in this country, if you're a politician, the best thing to do is get on board. But Berkshire is going to do what it thinks makes sense for its shareholders. And we like investing in companies that think that way, too. And not all companies obviously do.
Thanks for listening to this section of the Berkshire Hathaway's annual Shareholders Meeting podcast. The next section can be found in the next episode in your podcast feed. Please go check it out. If you enjoy this podcast, leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.